In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
The federal government aims to reclassify marijuana. South Dakota leaders say that move would hurt the state. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, July 23rd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley joins us. We'll talk about the potential reclassification and the state's opposition to it. Then, when you teach in America, you teach students largely protected by the U.S. Constitution. Our Teacher Talk conversation today explores the landmark U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Tinker v. Des Moines. We'll talk free speech in public schools and its limitations. Plus, the story of a return to France by a South Dakota family honoring the service of a World War II veteran who documented the liberation from Nazi Germany. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A Biden administration proposal to reclassify marijuana as a Schedule 3 drug under the Controlled Substances Act has entered the public comment phase. If approved, the reclassification could be a step towards fully legalizing marijuana at the federal level. Well, South Dakota is joining 10 other states in a letter of opposition saying the reclassification does not have proper authority and would harm the citizens of states like South Dakota. Joining me on the phone now for an update, we have South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley. Attorney General Jackley, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Lori.
This is a pretty significant change. When you put this in context, how big of a change would this reclassification, should it go through, be?
On the federal side, it would be fairly significant. However, on the state side, there really would be no effect unless the legislature determined that it would also go along with that schedule change. Every legislative session, the legislature looks at those federal schedules and either adopts them or makes particular changes to that. So at this stage, it wouldn't have any effect on the legalization of marijuana in South Dakota. However, it could. The bigger effect will be what the voters say in November. The voters will have an opportunity in South Dakota, just like they did in medical marijuana when they legalized it in 2020, this November, to determine whether or not recreational marijuana will be legal in our state.
And so the federal government does not have authority over the state to make that rule change legally? Help me understand how that works or where the exemptions might be. Because I can imagine somebody who's arrested in South Dakota would make the argument in court that, you know, it's been reclassified. Help me understand that.
It kind of almost boils down to separate sovereigns. So the federal government can have its own rules and schedules what's permissible under federal law. And then the states likewise get to say what our speed limits are, what our drug laws are. For example, some states like Nebraska do not have medical marijuana or recreational. Here in South Dakota, we have medical marijuana, but recreational is illegal. So the states have that ability. Now, oftentimes the states will adopt the federal schedules 1 through 5. That's typically what we do here in South Dakota, but we don't have to. And so ultimately, the voters of South Dakota are really going to decide this issue come November. One of the things, though, that the attorney generals were concerned about is how the Biden administration, was really specifically Attorney General Garland, appears to be circumventing the DEA. He hasn't had the proper chain of command. The head of the DEA or the DEA administrator has not signed off on important documents. And so this was a challenge of process where the attorney generals are saying, you're the attorney general of the United States. You need to follow proper process and protocol. And we spent 40 pages demonstrating to him how that has not happened. And again, making the plea or urging in this comment process to let the states decide.
All right. So President Biden called for a review of federal marijuana laws back in 2022. There's a recommendation from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. As you mentioned, Attorney General Merrick Garland has signed on to this, but no DEA. So you're saying the process has been subverted.
Yes. In other words, Ann Milgram, the administrator of the DEA, needed to do more things. There needed to be more protective process put in place, and that just simply has not happened.
Another argument in this letter, and you mentioned Nebraska, and they're brought up, you know, especially because they don't have recreational marijuana approval, but that it would turbocharge an industry that is going to have some benefits that other industries do not have. Help us understand how this reclassification, in your viewpoint, would harm people in states like Nebraska and also, of course, South Dakota.
Well, the harm comes on the state law and the state processes that are put in place. I use the example in Nebraska. Marijuana, whether it's recreational or medical, is illegal. In South Dakota, right now, as we speak, medical is legal, but recreational is not. And so that particular harm is focused on respecting state law. We have in place in South Dakota, with respect to our medical marijuana laws that were put in place in 2020 by the voters, a scheme that is the testing and it's run by Department of Health. So we put those things in place that just simply aren't going to exist if Attorney General Garland has his way. And again, this isn't just me. This is 11 attorneys general, and a lot of it coming from the Midwest because of our laws in relation to marijuana. It's Nebraska, it's South Dakota, it's Iowa. It's kind of the Midwestern belt saying, if you're going to do this, number one, take a step back and look at what the states are doing and respect state laws. Number two, follow the proper process when you do that and include the DEA that really is the organization that should be weighing in heavy on the schedules.
Let's talk about the schedules so people really understand. Schedule 2, where marijuana is at now, includes heroin, LSD. It's the most severe. There's no medical use for things in Schedule 2, high potential for abuse. This is how I understand it, so you'll be able to correct me if I'm wrong about those in a minute. But Schedule 3 moves it to, you know, being with Tylenol, with codeine, for example, saying there is a currently accepted medical use for what's on Schedule 3. It has a low potential for dependence. Help us understand, because common sense would say marijuana is a lot, it does have an accepted medical use. We voted on that. Why should it be in Schedule 2 versus Schedule 3?
Well, of course, the schedules become somewhat confusing, in particular when you're dealing with marijuana, because you start talking about THC and you start talking about hemp. But generally speaking, what Attorney General Garland is trying to do is to take marijuana from that Schedule 1 that basically says it does not have a medical value, high addictive, and move it to Schedule 3. And so if that were to happen, that would be how the federal authorities handle it. But again, the way this works, because we have 50 different states with 50 different laws, the state legislatures will decide whether or not they adopt the schedules. And so just because there's a comment and ultimately the federal government would shift it from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 3, the South Dakota legislature in January would still need to act upon that. And I think the reality is here in South Dakota, the voters are simply going to decide this issue in November. There's a ballot measure out there. There'll be a lot of discussion about that and other ballot measures. And ultimately, just like we did here in South Dakota on medical marijuana, the voters will decide. The people will be able to make that informed decision. And that's probably what's going to affect this more necessarily than what Attorney General Garland is trying to do, particularly in light of the fact that he's not including the DEA administrator.
I think I misspoke. I think I said Schedule 2, and I should have said Schedule 1. Okay. So
it gets confusing. There's five of them.
Thank you for that.
And again, it gets even more confusing because you start throwing hemp out there and you start talking about percentages. And so, yeah, the look at what Garland is trying to do without the DEA right now is move it from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 3, which makes it, frankly, a lower-level felony. But the federal authorities haven't prosecuted marijuana for years. Back when I was United States Attorney for those 4 years, we were not actively prosecuting marijuana. In fact, there was a general rule when it came to marijuana grows that if it was under 99 plants, we weren't really acting upon it. And, of course, the bad guys always figured out, well, then plant, you know, under 100 plants, and so the U.S. attorney will stay away from you. We've had those marijuana grow challenges here in South Dakota. Folks may remember Flandreau, where, again, federal authorities didn't act. It was me as Attorney General and state's attorney and the sheriff that acted. And so this particular change by Garland, ironically, will not likely have an enforcement effect much in South Dakota and other states. It may have an effect if our legislature would ultimately change those schedules. I don't see that happening. I think the legislature will likely defer to the people, which they should. The people are going to decide this in November, and that's what's going to really determine how we're going to handle marijuana moving forward here in South Dakota, at least on the criminal side.
Do you think the timing of this is political then, as we move to a November election?
Yes. I mean, absolutely. It's political by the Attorney General. That's what he's doing. And I think he's now been called out on it by a significant number of attorney generals in a 40-page letter to him saying, this is the proper procedure. You didn't follow it. You need to follow it.
Yeah. Do you think that marijuana has been over-criminalized in your law enforcement career and your career as attorney general and U.S. attorney?
Certainly, I've dealt with marijuana as a criminal defense lawyer and as a prosecutor. When I was a young prosecutor and I sat in more debriefings, oftentimes marijuana was the triggering cause for more serious drugs, whether it be methamphetamine, heroin, cocaine, not always, but certainly there's an argument to be made that this particular drug can be a gateway drug. And so we have seen problems with it. My bigger concern, too, as Attorney General, are what is happening with respect to protecting folks on our roads. I mean, obviously, when you use marijuana and you drive, that can affect your decision-making. And we've had some pretty significant tragedies here in South Dakota with that. And so those are just things that I've always asked the legislators and the voters to consider when looking at the legalization of marijuana. I was one of the first individuals, as Attorney General, testified to the South Dakota legislature that I felt we reached a point where if we did it responsibly, medical marijuana made sense. I worked with then-Senator Curd on that. I believe that was the right choice. Our laws right now are not ready to deal with complete legalization of marijuana when it comes to protecting our roads. It doesn't mean our legislature couldn't do that, but those are some of the concerns that I have as Attorney General.
Yeah. Let's do a quick pivot because I want to ask for a follow-up about this indictment for theft from Child Protective Services. And, of course, it's early to be talking about this, but I'm wondering $1.8 million of employee theft. If you have, for context, can you compare that case to previous fraud or embezzlement cases that have made top headlines in the state?
I think the answer is yes. Maybe not over this 13 period of time like has happened in the DSS-related indictment, but if you look back at Gear Up, you look back at EB-5, those were significant thefts. Those were instances when the state needed to have stronger protections in place. Certainly the legislature and past governors have looked at putting controls in place. Now the discussion is going to be whether those controls actually worked. I've pretty openly said, as Attorney General, I've had to deal with prosecutions in EB-5, prosecutions in Gear Up, and now prosecutions in this case. It's time that the legislature take a strong look at this and what they're doing with respect to the monitoring, and they are. I've had good conversations with several state senators and representatives. I would anticipate that hearings will start. You know, I want to make sure that I'm clear, too, as Attorney General, Governor Noem's team found the discrepancies, the financial discrepancies, and immediately brought us in. I've had good conversations with Governor Noem regarding this, and I feel that the executive branch this time is going to take a strong look at what protections are there and put some additional ones in place, and I feel that the legislature is likewise going to be working with the executive branch to put some protections in place so that we are not dealing with one of these significant scandals about every 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. Final question, Sturgis Rally coming up. What's the role of your office during that time frame? What do you want to leave us with?
Probably the biggest thing is we work with local, state, and federal authorities to have a presence. We work with those task forces to be proactive in protecting on the violent crime side, particularly with children and with respect to drug use. The Sturgis Rally has a special place in my heart. Sturgis is my hometown. It's where my mom still lives. I was able to grow up seeing the benefit the rally brings to the Black Hills and the state. It's a good business opportunity, a time to showcase the beautiful Black Hills and all that our state has to offer. And our job here in law enforcement is just to keep things as safe as we can, to be proactive when we can, and to recognize there will be times when we have to be reactive. We had the officer-involved shooting last year during the rally. Mm-hmm. We'll have instances when our proactive operations are, you know, bringing in individuals that have not acted appropriately. But overall, we plan to have that presence. The business owners always welcome us in, and I appreciate that as Attorney General. And we have strong working relationships with the local sheriffs, the chiefs. I know them on a personal level for many years, and we just hope everybody has a safe and enjoyable rally.
Marty Jackley, South Dakota Attorney General, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lori.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Do students have First Amendment rights while they are in the classroom? How about on campus? Can you wear a black armband, a controversial t-shirt? What does it mean to have a voice as a young person in America? If you're a teacher or a parent of a student in public school, free speech issues in the classroom matter. Our Teacher Talk educators have been examining landmark U.S. Supreme Court cases and exploring what they mean in today's classroom. Today's case, Tinker v. Des Moines. Before we get started, let's introduce our teachers. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center for Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota School of Education. She began her career in public education in 2007. She's been a middle school, a high school teacher, and a public librarian. Gina Benz teaches at Roosevelt High School in Sioux Falls, including in the Teacher Pathway Program. She is a recipient of the prestigious Milken Educator Award, and she is an adjunct professor at the University of South Dakota, the University of Sioux Falls, and Augustana. We'll start out here when I asked Gina Benz to explain the Tinker free speech case.
This was in the 1960s. And it happened not far from where we are right now, so Des Moines, Iowa. In fact, just a few months ago, I drove by Roosevelt High School in Des Moines, which my daughter goes to college near Des Moines. And everyone, when she says she went to Roosevelt, everyone thinks she went to that Roosevelt.
Sure, yeah.
And it wasn't just Roosevelt High School, though. It was also Harding Junior High and North High School. There were five students who all agreed to wear black armbands to school. Simply put, it was to protest the Vietnam War, but let me get more specific. The black armband was a way to mourn the soldiers who had died in Vietnam, and it was also a call to a Christmas truce, if you will, at the time, because this occurred in mid-December. Well, the five students wore their armbands. What was surprising to me is when I listened to John Tinker and his sister Mary Beth Tinker talk about this, they weren't called down to the office immediately. It was more like the middle of the day. And John refused to remove his armband and was sent home and suspended. He was punished. Mary Beth took hers off, but she was still suspended because she had worn it.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, isn't that? And so the armbands, they were able to suspend these students for wearing them because not long before this all happened, the school district officials had caught wind that this might happen, and so they made a policy, they made a rule right away that said you can't do that. They didn't want protests, I guess, to be happening in school. The Tinkers, as well as the others, they had broken a rule, and that's why they were suspended.
All right. This is the part where we remind listeners that nobody here is a legal scholar in this conversation, but we are talking about how some of these cases have impacted education and is still impacting education today. What exactly, Gina, was the decision here and how, and then we'll get into a little bit of the impact.
The decision was that the students were allowed to wear the armbands. In other words, this is a free speech decision, and that students do still have free speech when they are at school. Some also try to apply this to staff. It's a little bit more tricky with staff because if you're representing your school, mm-hmm. you don't necessarily have free speech as you do in your personal life when you're only representing yourself. But students have free speech as long as it doesn't create a substantial disruption to the learning environment. Mm-hmm. So the armbands didn't create a substantial disruption. They're allowed.
According to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1969. Okay. Now we are still seeing, hot button issue. And you know what? If you want to be a teacher, you're going to be in, you work with parents, mm-hmm. You work with students, and you work with the school board, you work with administrators, and you live in a society. So there is going to be a hot button issue. I'm sure we can all relate to how difficult it must have been to teach during the Vietnam era, because we have our mm-hmm. own hot button issues today that are bringing up new cases all the time. Jackie, tell us a little bit about what this is looking like now when we think about free speech in the classroom for students. What comes to mind to you, ripped from the headlines?
Yeah. Well, I want to add briefly before I talk about recent headlines that it's a good reminder that while it sometimes feels like we are living in this really unique period of history, which we absolutely are, in which there are so many different beliefs, it's also always been this way, right? Like, part of our culture is that we debate, we disagree, we have free speech, which is such a gift. And so I really appreciate the Tinker case, and I love talking about it because it reminds students, too, that they have a voice, that they have free speech. And I think that's an incredibly important right that is needs to be reminded to all students.
Yeah. You are teaching Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Who are protected by the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. But back to your original question, which is, how is this showing up in our current society? One of the cases that's coming up that was just ruled on here recently was that there was a middle schooler who wore a T-shirt that said, "There are only two genders." And the courts, it was the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit in Boston, they ruled unanimously, and I'm going to quote this directly here, that precisely because the message was reasonably understood to be so demeaning of some other students' gender identities, there was the potential for back-and-forth negative comments and slogans between factions of students that could lead to a deterioration in the school's ability to educate its students. So that second half of the Tinker ruling, and again, I'll make the same joke I made on the previous segment, not a lawyer, not playing one on TV, but that second half of the Tinker ruling that said, if it's causing a disruption to other students or to the learning environment, that's where free speech ends. And so the courts ruled in this case that that had happened with this T-shirt.
All right. The T-shirt said there are only two genders, which the court said that tips over the line. You can't say that somebody else doesn't exist, essentially. Okay, so this is super wonderful and delightful and messy, and there's so much to unpack here. And Gina, the simple act of wearing a T-shirt in a politically divided time, you must see shirts come in and out of the high school classroom all the time that make you want to raise your eyebrows, whether you do or not.
Well, I will say that a key here is that is the shirt attacking somebody? And the court believes in this case it is attacking. You know, imagine if there's a transgender student in the room who is staring at the T-shirt. That can be really disruptive for that student's learning for sure. But there was another court case, and I'm sorry that I can't say what it, I can't remember what its title was, but a student wore a shirt to school that said, "Be happy, not gay." And that one was ruled to be okay. And I think it's because it wasn't demeaning, it wasn't an attack. And so there's a really fine line, and mm-hmm. school officials have a really tough job in making that decision. You know, you could have students who are wearing a Confederate flag. That's been a big concern for some principals. How do you address that? Some will say it's a historical thing. Some will say it's a racist thing.
Obviously, we've seen on college campuses this idea of what is disruptive and what is free speech with the war in Gaza, with Free Palestine protests. So where for you as teachers, you're going into a new school district, I'm guessing you want to know the policy. And then I'm guessing you want to think ahead of time how you're going to handle certain things. That's what I would do anyway. Mm-hmm. Jackie, tell me a little bit about if you're taking a new job and you know Somebody might be coming in with a shirt that says Free Palestine. Well, what am I going to say about that if that shirt bothers somebody else, particularly a Jewish student who feels threatened by that and feels like it's a call for genocide? This might come up in my classroom. What am I going to do? Help walk through some of the ways that teachers and administrators talk about these things before anybody just reacts spontaneously to a t-shirt that maybe takes them by surprise.
Sure. I want to remind folks that we do this kind of preemptive thinking all the time. It's a large part of being a teacher, is to anticipate what could go awry, what could be surprising, what kind of things could come up, and have a plan for those things. So I encourage all new teachers, those going into the profession, to ask a lot of questions. There's no harm in asking a lot of questions and gathering a lot of information. Mm-hmm. There will be administrators to help you who will have policies in place, or you might be putting something on their radar that they didn't have on their radar for a policy that does need to be put in place. You can also talk to veteran teachers in your school, those who have encountered various t-shirts, various conversations like this, like what do we do in these instances? And then I'll echo what I said in the previous segment, which is that you're not always going to get it right. There are times when I acted on something, I wish I hadn't. There are times when I didn't act on something, I wish I had. And so to know that that's part of the evolution of becoming a teacher is that as you have various experiences, you'll get a better sense of the ways that you respond best to those circumstances. And that there's not like as though there's a bright line of this was the right thing to do and this was the wrong thing to do. When a student comes in your classroom wearing a t-shirt that causes controversy, there's not a this is how one should act. No one would agree upon that. We couldn't come up with that as a society. And so recognizing that there's a lot of nuance, a lot of circumstances that will go into determining what the course of action would be in those situations.
Now, equally interesting to the cases that the Supreme Court decides are the cases that they turn down or don't let come in front of them. And Jackie, you pointed out in Education Weekly this story about the Supreme Court turning away a case that would challenge a transgender policy. Tell us a little bit about this idea that parents would say, we need to know if our child is coming to a teacher and saying, hey, use a different pronoun for me. That bothers us. We don't want our student to be using a different pronoun. And teachers feeling like a student trusts them, they're asking them to refer to them in a certain way, and they don't necessarily, you know, feel comfortable in that scenario, telling the parents because of things that they might know. It's very complicated. We don't have time to unpack it all. But tell me a little bit about a case like this and how it informs what you're teaching new teachers or what you might think is a value to bring to your own classroom.
I think that, wow, what a large question to ask. Yeah. And also one that's coming up, right? Like I taught in this very situation. I do teach, now that I'm at the collegiate level, it's a little different. But yes, I've absolutely taught where students had preferred pronouns and their parents preferred that they not use those preferred pronouns. What do you do? Mm-hmm. And I think that it is perpetually at this stage in the conversation of a case-by-case basis. Depending on the school district that you're in, depending on the state that you're in, depending on the student, depending on the parent, there will be different answers for that. And so I think, again, asking a lot of questions of all involved parties will be incredibly important. But the thing I always try to remind people is that the most important person in the room when you're a teacher are those students in front of you. And so to be looking out for their best interest, to be looking out for their well-being, to be listening to what they have to say, to be advocating for them is your role. But your role is also not their parent, and your role is also not the administrator. Your role is also not on the Supreme Court. Your role is also not a counselor. And so to remember that you are, while sometimes it feels like you are asked to be so many of those things, you actually aren't. You are just asked to be their teacher. And that's an incredibly important role, one to take seriously, but also one that doesn't fill in all these other roles. And so sometimes it was determined that the parents had made this conclusion and we were going with the pronouns that they were given at birth. And I tried to call those students by their name as much as possible so that I just didn't use a pronoun with them. And sometimes it was ruled that we got to go by the pronouns that they preferred. And so again, it's just going to be a case-by-case situation.
Yeah. That's a mic drop. That's a mic drop, Jackie. Anything I would have said, you said, and I just will emphasize two parts. When my own future teachers start getting concerned about all these really messy, complicated issues, I say, you should defer to the principal. The principal is there to help you and protect you, mm-hmm. and you don't have to do all this on your own. Go to the principal. Go to a counselor. There's a team of people to help you, and that's their job. Your job is to teach. They have a job when it comes to policies and rules. And the second thing, you said you use their name as much as possible instead of a pronoun. And sometimes you really can get by in a conversation without using a name or a pronoun. Now, I'm not saying that's ideal. I'm just saying that's a way you can navigate that if need be.
It mm-hmm. seems to me that so much of the language questions that we have had can be solved by simply thinking about what you say before you say it. Do you need mm-hmm. to say, boys and girls, pay attention? Or can you say, first graders, look, mm-hmm. look up here? I mean, do you have to make some of those statements, or can you work on your language? My daughter's kindergarten teacher always called them can-do kindergartners. And so they were always, or friends. She called mm-hmm. them all friends. And I don't think that was any... There was nothing behind it other than she wanted them to be friends, and they wanted them to have can-do attitudes, and that was the most important thing she was imparting. It wasn't a political conversation. And I hope what people are hearing from this is that, if you're worried about becoming a teacher because the world is political, that maybe you can take a deep breath and realize that there are an awful lot of teachers out there navigating all this and more on the daily. And we don't have to be afraid of having these conversations, Jackie.
No, I couldn't agree more. I think that keeping in mind that the youth of America need good role models, need people that care for them, need people that believe in education, is the reason to join the profession. And that any profession is going to have reasons not to, but they are not extraordinary in this field. In fact, I think this conversation around politics is all the more reason to participate, because your voice matters in these political conversations as an educator. Your input about all of these things matters. We wouldn't have these Supreme Court cases if people hadn't spoken up. And so I think that that's something to keep in mind as well.
And you are empowering young people so that one day their voice will matter. Mm-hmm. You're giving them the tools they need to think critically, speak eloquently, and find their avenue for making a difference themselves.
Yes. And I also think that just by being brave enough to navigate a lot of these conversations is the salve that we need as a nation right now, to be able to see an adult say, mm-hmm. hey, your parents said this, you feel this way, how can we move forward so that mm-hmm. you and I have a good relationship and we can get through this school year well? That having someone do that for you is important. And so, yeah, I just think that that is something to really value in oneself as an educator, is your ability to work with all different types of people, to navigate difficult situations, and see through the other side. And the youth of America need to see us as adults doing those types of things more.
Yeah, that's a beautiful idea, that we can model civil discourse, that we can model collaboration and working together as opposed to fighting and getting defensive or offensive.
You can find all the companion blogs online at sdpb.org/teachertalk. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. General Patton's Third Army swept through France during World War II, playing a pivotal role in the liberation from Nazi Germany. 80 years later, a South Dakota family uncovered a photo of a French family and an apple orchard. And that photo had been taken by an officer in Patton's Third Army, Ted Cooper. So Bill Cooper is Ted Cooper's son. Lucy George Cooper is Ted's granddaughter. And they are with us now in the Kirby Family Studio with a remarkable story of connection. Lucy, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
And Bill, thank you as well.
Thank you, Lori.
Let's start with the photograph. Bill, you're going through your father's documents and papers, in what context, and tell me a little bit about why this particular photo captured your interest.
Well, back it began in on the 75th anniversary of D-Day, when I decided to take the day off from work and to begin to really look more closely at my father's photo album from World War II and begin to digitize those photos for posterity. And about four or five pages in, I saw this just gorgeous photo of a French family looking over a stone wall. It looked like a mother and seven children looking at the photographer, my dad, and others who may have been with him. And underneath that photo was his inscription, "The Blandimore family, our neighbors in Nehu, Normandy." And, of course, my first thought was, where is Nehu, Normandy, and who are the Blandimores?
Yeah. How did you begin finding answers to that?
Well, literally in the next 20 minutes, thanks to Google Maps, I was able to find Nehu. And then I did a Google search for Blandimores near Nehu, found two locations with the name, and when I looked at one of the Blandimore family addresses on Google Maps, it literally had a place adjacent to it called Camp Patton, which is something I had never heard of and Dad had never mentioned. And so then I went to the street view, and I actually could see what looked like the wall across from Camp Patton, where this photo may have been taken. And I decided one day I want to stand on that road and look at that wall and maybe even meet some of the family members.
Lucy, tell me, when you first heard this story, what were some of your thoughts?
Yeah, so certainly a powerful story. You know, my grandfather taught me backgammon as a little girl, and I got to know him a little bit, and but never in the context of what may have been happening earlier on in his life. And so to kind of hear this connection, to hear about this family, really, you know, I'll say I speak French, and so kind of the start was a request to translate a letter, which made me a little nervous. But it was pretty cool to, you know, hear about my dad going through some of these photos and wanting to find the family. You know, I was a little nervous at first, a cold call to a family in a different country. But yeah, very, very powerful thing to kind of think that this photo, obviously at the time when I heard it, didn't know what would come of it. But
Bill, what happened next?
Well, Lucy translated this letter, and my wife takes students overseas regularly, and so I joined her after one of those trips, with the caveat that we travel to Normandy. So this would be January of 2020, and we went to Camp Patton, my wife and I, and daughter Camille and her husband Miguel, and son Sam, and we looked around at the apple orchard and at the monuments they had there, and then walked across the street and knocked on the farmhouse door. No one answered, and so we put the letter in the mailbox. We had to travel later that day or the next day away from there, but I had left my email and phone number and all that, and literally Christoph Blandimore, the son of one of those family members, reached out to me that next night by text, and we began conversing and getting to know one another.
What was it like to stand by that stone wall?
You know, it's an incredibly emotional place to be literally in the location where your father was 80 years before, not knowing whether he was going to live or die, and having his close calls, and to imagine that vibrant family there that were so incredibly, and still are, so incredibly grateful for what we as a country did for them and for Europe by fighting that war and liberating them.
Lucy, one of the things that sticks with me is the caption on the picture saying our neighbors.
Yeah.
These are our neighbors when we're staying in this place. Put into context what this means for you, if you can even scratch that surface for us.
Yeah, so certainly, you know, the power of being there and being present to help people, you know, a world away. Is very significant, and now that context has even changed more for us. You know, this family has really become a family for us. I had the opportunity to meet them and to speak with them and to celebrate a birthday with them, and so that the neighbor, you know, really at that time when my grandfather was there meant a significant thing to him, and even to this day, you know, as we continue to form this relationship, is a very large. Large word for us as well, because across an ocean we can still, you know, classify ourselves as neighbors and friends and family.
Yeah. Are the apples still on the trees?
The apple trees that were there 80 years ago have passed away, as have many of the soldiers, but they have replanted them. Helen Patton, General Patton's granddaughter, has been a pivotal player in creating this memorial to her grandfather and the troops who were there, because it was such a pivotal part of their preparations for the breakout and for what was to come in Europe. And so she has purchased, or the foundation has purchased, the apple orchard from the Blandemore family, and they have replanted apple trees. And in fact, this past 2 weeks ago, we were there for the 80th celebration of the arrival of the Third Army in that apple orchard and surrounding area. And the Blandemore family and several others dug a hole and got us over to a surprising planting of an apple tree, which was a very powerful moment with Christoph and me planting this apple tree, because I know my father loved the country and loved trees, and I planted many trees with him at our farm, and it just, there was just this history there. He would have loved for a tree to be planted there in to replace some of those that got blown over by the storm last year.
Thank you so much for sharing just a small portion of this story with us. I just have so many questions for you. For our emotions, we're going to take a pause, because I'm going to cry here in about, and then the show's over. So thank you for being here with us. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Jackie Hendry has stepped into the Kirby family studio now. We are going to talk a little bit about what she and the South Dakota Focus team are working on this summer. Jackie, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Lori. Glad to be here.
Tell me a little bit about the upcoming season of South Dakota Focus. And let's start with how you make decisions and pick what the season is even going to be, because that's a big...
Yeah. That's a big process, yeah?
Last season, it is. Last season was a bit of an experiment. In previous seasons, every episode has been on a different particular topic. Last season, we decided to devote the entire season of episodes to issues related to children in South Dakota. So we had episodes about child care, child trauma, education, these sorts of things all under one umbrella. And it was a really impactful season. Yeah. We were able to really snowball our sources. It was also kind of an emotionally heavy season because we're dealing with a lot of deeper topics. So then for this upcoming 30th season of South Dakota Focus, we wanted to do something similar, but pivot a little bit to something with similarly high stakes as, you know, the future generations of South Dakota and with wide-ranging impact. And we ended up landing on this idea of tourism. Yeah. It's the state's second largest industry, huge impact. Every community in the state is in some way impacted by the tourism industry. And it also gives us an opportunity to experience some of those big draws of things that make other people fall in love with South Dakota and also what that means for the broader community.
I love some of your stories about coming to South Dakota for the first time. You have a personal connection to South Dakota tourism that is life-changing.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
I'm here because of South Dakota tourism. I was 13 years old, my mom and dad and I from Illinois driving through South Dakota, ultimately on a journey to Yellowstone. But we spent a few days in the Black Hills because my parents came in the 80s on motorcycles and wanted to show me Mount Rushmore and these different things. And I remember looking out the car window at the hills and like craning my neck, and I'd never seen a landscape like this before. And we visited Crazy Horse, and that was my first introduction to Native histories, Native cultures, and this period of history. And I just was captured by South Dakota. Mm. And from Crazy Horse, found a newsletter about the University of South Dakota, and the rest is in a lot of ways history for me. But that South Dakota tourism, I mean, that was the gateway. And as I'm working on this next season, I'm finding that's the case for a surprising amount of other people that
really
are brought in.
How old would you have been then?
Oh,
roughly?
I was 13, I think.
13.
Yeah. 13
okay.
years old, and here we are.
At what point did you feel like this was home?
Oh, wow, that's an interesting question. A couple years into college,
yeah,
I think. It took that because I had never been away from home for a long time before, but I found that niche, and I thought, this is it.
Yeah. What are some of the places that you know that you're headed to? Give us a little preview of some upcoming episodes.
Right. Well, next week we'll be on the road to Sturgis. We're kicking off our season with the state's largest tourism event, the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. We already got some FaceTime with folks in Sturgis and Nemo last week. We'll be back for the early days of the rally. Mm-hmm. So that'll be the kickoff of our season on tourism. But we also just visited DeSmet for the Laura Ingalls Wilder pageant. We'll be going to a whole bunch of other places around the state. We went to Hot Springs. We've been to the Dupree area for a cattle branding for the emerging niche of agritourism.
Sure.
We have all kinds of adventures yet to have.
All right. Surprises are ready for you after living here as long. I mean, there's places you've been to that I haven't been.
Yeah.
And certainly there's some lifelong South Dakotans that haven't been to some of these places. What surprises you that you've already put in your pocket and said, this changes everything?
Well, I'm going back to the Mammoth site because I had never visited before. We were able to visit with them. We're talking about some like science tourism and those family-based attractions that are fun but also educational for those families that we invite to visit with us. And that's one of those things that I'll be going back. I picked up a little plush mammoth that I've named Wolford Brimley, and he is a delight to me. And everyone at the Mammoth site was great to work with.
All right. We are excited for the upcoming season of South Dakota Focus and to follow your journeys on social media throughout the summer as you just jump in with both feet. Jackie Hendry, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lori.
That is our show for today. We hope that it served you from all of us at SDPB. Tomorrow, our Dakota Political Junkies are going to dive in to, a few political headlines that have happened this week. Tune in for that from all of us here. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.